Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. This morning, I'm very happy indeed to introduce you to John Gillis, the renowned historian, now retired from Rutgers University and living in the Bay Area. John was educated at Amherst College and Stanford University, where he became an historian, and he's actually produced a book on that subject, which we'll get back to toward the end of the program. John tells me his interests as a historian have wandered a bit. He began studying Germany, then moved to British history, then to the Atlantic world. He has written a book on the family, and now he's written a book about the sea, or the shore, really. His new book, just out from the University of Chicago Press, is The Sea Coast in History, The Human Shore. This is, we have to say, something that is an issue, I think, to many of us this morning. So welcome, John Gillis. Can I call you John?
Certainly, Cal. All
right.
I can call you Cal.
So you can.
Just one small correction. It's The Human Shore, Sea Coast in History.
So okay, I got it backwards.
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay. John, it must be impossible for you this morning not to be thinking about the shore. You spent many years in New Jersey. You must be thinking in particular about the Jersey Shore. And but I think you're probably thinking about it also in terms of what you've been studying and writing about in the most recent past. Could you begin with some thoughts about what's going on this week?
Sure, sure. My very first experience as almost as a toddler was the Jersey Shore, in fact, Atlantic City. And I was born in 39, so I was there probably in something like 43, 44. My parents lived in Jersey. And at that point, the shore was a wreck, not because of weather, but because of the war. I can remember vividly seeing tar on the sands, pieces of boats washed up, and there was a sense that something dangerous lurked offshore, which, of course, were Nazi submarines and so on. So, yes, my thoughts on the shore have are very fresh in some ways. My memories of the shore are fresh. And my thoughts today are for the shore, which has really taken the hit. That has been totally ripped apart. The boardwalk is apparently in shambles. And it will be a long time before things are back to anything like normal, although I hope they actually don't go back to normal, because I think the normal is not the right place for what we're talking about.
And well, we have to ask you then, what do you mean by that, the normal and the not so normal?
Well, the normal, if you take the coast as a natural phenomena, the coast, particularly that part of the East Coast, consists of sand constantly moving, of barrier islands, which consist of sand, which is produced by in the deep ocean, and then moves toward the land to create places like Ocracoke and many of the shore resorts in Jersey and the many of the islands just south of Long Island itself. So what I'm talking about, when you talk about the natural shore, you're talking about something that is constantly moving, a little more land one day, a little less, a little more sea the next. That's the way Rachel Carson described it accurately. But the shore today is, of course, one of our most built-up areas. There's been, in the last 40 years, a huge shift of population toward the shore. Something like 53% of all Americans now live in what is described as a coastal zone. Around the world, more than half the population live within 100 miles of the shore. As we can see from the superstorm, living on the shore can be anything from, 5 yards to 150, 200 miles now with these superstorms.
I saw sort of a shocking statistic that you might just fit into this in a discussion about the recession in Spain. I read that during the housing bubble that basically the whole coastline of Spain had been paved over, and I've only been to Spain once as a student, but it was a spectacular place. Is that part of your subject?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was in Spain last spring, and as we toured the Basque coast, which is the northern coast, I was stunned by the development of these high rises, even in the most pastoral areas, and they were largely empty. The overbuilding in Spain has just been phenomenal, and that's actually the core of their economic crisis, is their housing crisis. But to the larger point, yes, your metaphor of paving over is absolutely on the mark, because what has happened is that not only have we moved ever closer to the shore, built right up on the ocean, but we've used materials, particularly in seawalling and groining and so on, which are totally unproductive, or in fact they're counterproductive, because studies have shown that the more you seawall a coast, the more it erodes, the more the sea defies this kind of human engineering. So the results, for example, on the Carolina coast and in Japan, where 65% of the coast is now concreted over, have been absolutely disastrous, not just for the natural environment, as you could imagine, but also for the human populations, which now are confronted with ever stronger evidence of erosion and pollution and all that.
Well, let's go back to your book and back in time a bit to kind of and first maybe a word about how you just specifically how you chose this topic, but then tell us about beginning your book with what's sometimes called prehistory, but which a term which I think you don't really like that much. But let's turn to the book, The Human Shore, and to how you begin it in the story of the early story of mankind, humankind.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you started me out on that foot. As a historian of the modern period, I was quite unacquainted with what is called prehistory. When I began to read the literature of archaeologists and prehistorians and anthropologists, I was just astounded at how much it's now known about the earliest human habitation of the shore. One of the greatest discoveries in the 1980s was a place called Pinnacle Point on the very southern tip of South Africa, where caves revealed human habitation about 164,000 years ago. And what was astounding about this human habitation is that this was not just some kind of early man, but it was Homo sapiens. And evidence of tool making, of the use of ochre to paint faces and so on, suggests that it was at the shore that human civilization actually began. So this got me going on a theme which I have fleshed out in the book of thinking about the shore as the original home of mankind, the point from which we have moved out into the world. We have colonized the world from Africa by 15,000 B.C. These people had reached the very tip of South America. And this has been the story of mankind ever since. But it's a neglected story because partly because of this disjuncture between prehistory and modern history. We don't see the continuity, but also because of the dismissive attitude of most historians who are landlubbers to the sea itself and to the coast as a place of origin. So if this book succeeds in doing one thing, it will be to turn history inside out and suggest that we really have to begin human history at the shore, not some mythical Eden inland, and to go from there. And I think we'll learn a lot if we sort of reverse our perspective.
Well, here's two points that I found interesting. I know that it's difficult to develop them in such a short period of time that we have, but you you say that looking at this early history, let's call it that, you found challenges to the idea of man the hunter, and challenges to thinking about gender in history. Am I right about that?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at the sustenance of the people at Pinnacle Point, it was it was shellfish and seaweed, and so gathering was far more important, and in fact has always been far more important than hunting human sustenance. But the Victorian gentlemen who invented prehistory and early anthropology as men privileged the hunter over the gatherer, who in most cases have been women and children. So again, this is a case where you can see how the gender issue, the writing women out of history, begins very early on with the myth of the great hunter and the shall we say the forgotten gatherer.
And the second point I had looking through that chapter was about your discussion of, and I ask this really to give the listener an idea of how you're developing your story. A second part that caught my attention was your discussion of what you call the oldest shore, the Indian Ocean.
Well, the Indian Ocean is not necessarily, well, yes, I guess you could call it the oldest shore in the sense that the Indian Ocean was the first to be crossed, and that was made possible by the monsoon seasons. The Indian Ocean was, in fact, visited later, somewhat a little bit later, by Pacific Islanders who made it all the way to Madagascar. So, yes, the Indian Ocean, from a certain point of view, is a pivot of history. The Atlantic, interestingly enough, is kind of the last ocean to be crossed. And so we've got our history a little bit wrong. We should be more Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean centered if we want to do global history right, a little less Mediterranean and Atlantic centered if we want to do it right.
And here's another question for you about not quite such an early period, but when I, muse, run my mind around sort of the bigger questions of history, one thing here is that I think maybe of Cairo on the Nile, or of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. The Rome is on a river, Paris, London, Dublin, and so forth, New York City. Why the move inland?
Well, the move inland is You mean upriver?
Upriver,
like
sure, yeah. Sure.
That was largely protective. The early coasts were, they were for hundreds of thousands of years visited regularly by hunter-gatherers, and that is well documented for every part of the world. Once agriculture began to develop, which is much later, the inland cities wanted to protect themselves from the coast, both because the sea was seen as a rather alien thing and a daunting thing, but also in the age, for example, the Vikings, 700 onward, from sea raiders. So most of the great cities initially were located somewhat upriver, away from the coast. The migration of cities to the coast, to the shore, is a relatively modern phenomenon, and now we're witnessing in New York and elsewhere the consequences of this. In the 17th century, for example, probably as much commerce was going up the Hudson River to Albany as it was in and around Manhattan. Now that may seem like a strange statement, but in California's case, as you probably know, San Francisco had its function as sort of kicking off the gold rush and so on, but it soon became apparent that Sacramento and Stockton were very important ports for agricultural exports and imports. So there are a lot of great stories about rivers and river towns and upriver ports and so on that needs to be explored here.
Okay, now another point you work on right through your book has to do with what you're grappling with, the idea of the relationship between humans and the sea. What are the primary things you're thinking about there?
Well, this is again as much an environmental. Let me reverse this. This is as much my interest in the humanities as in environmental history and environmental science. The relationship of humans to the sea is a material one, obviously, through fishing and hunter-gathering at the shore and shipping and so on. But it's also a deeply humanistic theme because the sea has had a very powerful meaning for humans, even humans who have never seen the sea. Have never visited the sea, have no contact with the sea. So the sea operates, at least in Western culture, as the kind of opposition, the alterity to land. The sea is chaos. The sea is awesome power, destructive power. The sea is death, whereas the land is nurturing. The land is orderly. The land is a source of security. So that kind of trope plays out from the Bible and even the pre-biblical Babylonian sources right through the early modern period, right in almost to the present. Because as Alan Corbin wrote in his book, The Lure of the sea and the coast, particularly the sea coast, were considered dangerous places until really the 19th century. And then people began to cultivate the coast for sightseeing, for resort activities, ultimately for swimming, bathing, and so on. So the relationship between the humanity, at least in the West, and the sea has been almost totally inverted. But the crucial point here is to point out that even as we have become so much more fond of going to the seaside, we have lost touch with the seaside itself, because we no longer have a large fishing population. Most of us are incompetent as sailors, so we stop at the edge of the sea now to look and to listen, but we don't any longer have any real material connection with the sea itself.
Well, let's come back to that in a minute. This is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. This morning, I'm talking to the historian John R. Gillis. John has just completed and just published a fascinating new study called The Human Shore, Sea Coasts and History. Did I get it right that time?
You did. Thank you,
okay,
Cal.
Okay, got it the right order.
Yeah.
So that's The Human Shore, Sea Coasts and History, just published by the University of Chicago, and we've been talking about various aspects of the shore. You also mention in this book the importance to you of Rachel Carson, and maybe you could tell us about that, and we could move a bit toward your interest in the environment.
Yeah, well, Rachel Carson is most famous for her Silent Spring, which was a bestseller for weeks, if not months, launched the anti-pesticide movement, launched what you might call the organic movement, I guess. But he wrote a couple other books which fascinate me. One is called The Edge of the Sea, and that's about coasts and tidal environments. And the other one is a marvelous lyrical, totally lyrical book called The Sea Around Us. Now, what's interesting about Carson is that she was an inlander. She grew up in Pennsylvania. She didn't come down to the sea until her mid-20s. In fact, you might say that she's sort of the pioneer of this new migration toward the sea, of which I regard myself as a part. But she came to value the sea, both for what she discovered there about the natural phenomena of the tidal areas, but also for the humanistic value. She said at one point, I'm not sure I can quote this correctly, she said, "We came from the sea." You know, that is certainly true if you go back millions of years. "But we will return to the sea," she said. And she was saying this in the 1950s already. If not physically, at least culturally, mentally and imaginatively. And this is a prophetic statement, because this is exactly what has happened. The sea has grown in our imaginations, in our mindsets, in our the landscapes of our minds so mightily over the 20th century, even among people, as I said before, who have never visited it, who know nothing of it, have no experience of it. So that's so Rachel Carson is my mentor, but at the same time, Rachel Carson was completely oblivious to one thing. Not her fault, because no one else had this insight. She called the sea incorruptible or uncorruptible. She viewed it as the last pristine place on Earth. She did not believe that all human activity on the sea or around the sea had touched it at all. And now we know, this was a complete reversal of this, that the sea is feeling the effects of thousands, of years of human contact. Its fish populations, its mammal populations, but the very nature of the sea itself, its acid levels, its temperature, which we're seeing acting out now on New York, are all products of human activity. So this is another classic example of climate change. We have not thought of climate change as directly affecting the seed. Certainly Rachel Carson had not one inkling of this, but here we are. And that is the lesson which we should be carrying away this week, this month, from Hurricane Sandy.
To be clear, so the lesson is?
The lesson is, first, that human activity on the sea, around the sea, has had profound influences on fish populations, on mammal populations, for hundreds of years. A new book by Jeff Bolster called The Mortal Sea makes this point. The title makes this point, The Mortal Sea versus the Eternal Sea or the Immortal Sea. But more than that, now climate scientists are telling us that the warming of the sea, which results in its expansion on one hand, the rising sea levels, which are partly due to warming, partly due to the melting of the of ice packs in Greenland and elsewhere, but also the warming connecting with the increased storm activity of hurricanes. It is warm seas that produce hurricanes. Those warm seas are now moving north and producing further and further along the northern coast of America, larger and more frequent and active storms. So climate change is now something that is directly linked to the sea and must be understood in those terms. That's not to say that a particular hurricane is the product of global warming as such. There are many factors involved, but the point being that global warming cannot be any longer put aside in this debate. And the shameful thing that is happening right now is I've yet to hear any politician talk about this recent storm connected with or associated with global warming. It is a stunning admission of their political cowardice. So there you go.
There you go. Amen. John, let's, if you don't mind, shift a little bit to California. We've got, I think I looked it up, 840 miles or so of shore, and a good number of those are up here in Mendocino County, going on 100, I think. And we have, you know, we here, we call ourselves, we say we live on the coast, as opposed to over the hill and the inland. So it's got to be an interesting subject for us, and interesting also that you, at least anecdotally, talk a bit about our own coast up here in Northern California, the North Coast. So, and one other thing to expand, to give you some room to roam on this question, you mentioned, and, you know, I've always been fascinated by Mike Davis's book, and The Ecology of Fear, and his take on the environment. So maybe you could begin to have begin with some comments about California, comments of your own choosing.
Oh, yes, please allow me to do this. I'm a bi-coastal person. I spend every summer for 50 years on a small island off the coast of Maine. I'm a coastal lover, shall we say, and I love the Mendocino coast. In fact, I love most of the California coast, except when you get down to, the megalopolises. But the California coast is a unique coast, very different from Maine. Maine has has an irregular coast, which has allowed for the development of a kind of fishery with many small harbors. Your part of the world, Mendocino, has had its harbors. They're called, in the olden days, doghole ports, where the timber could be lifted or literally thrown down the cliff into the holds of the schooners lined up along this very dangerous and rocky shore. And you do have your towns like Mendocino and elsewhere, which are reminders of this. You also have Fort Ross, which is a reminder of the rich, another kind of hunter-gatherer, the otter trade, and so on. So there's a marvelous set of histories connected with the coast, and not just San Francisco, not just Monterey, but all along the shore. And as you point out, the people living on the California coast really are different from inlanders, and they were different from the beginning. And the beginning is lost in prehistory. It is a Native American beginning. It is a beginning of hunter-gatherers coming down from the Bering Strait. At that time, the sea levels were much lower, so they walked, and some people even believe they may have canoed down along the coast as the entryway into the Americas. And there they established remarkable civilizations, not just up there in the Northwest where we have the great Haida and other Indian groups, but all along the coast, the Pomo in your part of the world, coming in these great migrations down to the shore on a seasonal basis to harvest, returning to the uplands, to the mountains, for the rest of the year. You have the Chumash people off of Santa Barbara on the Channel Islands there, who developed a very sophisticated prehistoric civilization. I could go up and down the coast. It's a remarkable and thrilling venture if you want to follow it. And then, of course, came the settlers, first by sea, not overland. The interesting thing is that apart from the Spanish and later the Mexicans, most of the coasts of the West have been settled by sea, from the sea. They were, in fact, it is said that that Oregon and parts of Washington were more like Maine and Massachusetts for a long time. Why? Because that's where their inhabitants initially came from and acted as if they were simply extensions of this eastern whaling and trading civilization. Monterey was called at one point Little Boston because it was so influenced by East Coast maritime history. So the America's been bicoastal for a hell of a long time, from the very beginning of, that is, Europeanized North America. And we can start from there. I mean, this is such a fascinating place on all levels. Yes, yes.
And what do you take the meaning of ecology of fear to be, least in terms of the shore?
Well, the ecology of fear, I think, is to say the least, a stunning and path-breaking book. It gave me, though, one concept that I have run with like the wind ever since, and that's the idea of the ecotone. The ecology of fear that Davis talks about in Southern California, and a coastal ecology of storms, but also fire, he develops this idea that there are unique places, usually mainly along shores, where two ecosystems interact. And normally, and he doesn't stress this, but I think he could have done more, because his emphasis is on fear rather than pleasure or fecundity. Ecotones are the richest environments. Why? Because you have two ecosystems to draw on. You have the inland system, and you have the coastal or the near shore system. So, for example, take the Ohlone people of the Bay Area. They were hunter-gatherers until the Mexicans and the Americans arrived. Part of their time was spent on the bay fishing and harvesting shrimp, various kinds of seafood. But then they had access to the rich back country of California, particularly the oak forests where they harvested famously the acorns, which they subsisted on. But they lived on both sides of the tide, you see. I mean, what a feast they had. They lived an extremely rich life. What Marshall Solins called the affluence of the prehistoric. These people lived well. They lived lightly on the land and the sea. They were well fed. We're pretty sure that many of them had rather long lives. They traded with other people, so they had a rich cultural background. This is Stone Age affluence. This is Stone Age affluence. Something that when you tell students about this and try to explain to them that these people worked on the average of probably 10 to 12 hours a week, with no stress or strain, gathering and hunting, moving about, they can scarcely believe it. And why should they? Because they have completely lost touch with this ecotonal environment, which has now been divided into sea and land by all kinds of barriers. I'm looking out at the bay right now, and there's no place for the Ohlone anymore. The wetlands are gone. They have been, built over. That ecotonal existence is no longer possible in most places in the so-called developed world. Now, there are plenty of places in the non-developed world where these still exist and support large populations, but not here, not here.
Okay, let me ask you this. I remember on one of my first visits to this part of the world, driving pretty much the length of the, at least the Northern California coast. I heard someone recently describe it as cockpit tourism. But, it is a beautiful ride up and down the coast. I was coming from Seattle down to San Francisco and going back up again. But I remember going back up again one time, and I don't know that I was much of an environmentalist at the time, a young student, but I have to say it's a vivid recollection being shocked when we came into Sea Ranch.
How about
Sea Ranch? That's in your book.
That certainly is, I know I won't offend too many people here, listening audience, but Sea Ranch is touted around the world as the most ecologically sensitive development of a coastal property that has ever existed. And Halpern, who was the Berkeley architect who designed it and promoted it, certainly knew what he was doing when he built the houses. And cited them the way he did, and I have nothing but praise for his architecture and his citing. But the point about Sea Ranch is that it is on the sea, but it is not of the sea. It is as I put it time and again in my book. Those people at Sea Ranch live on the sea, but they do not live with it. It took a long time for suits in courts to give coastal access in the Sea Ranch territory. But more than that, it's interesting. Halpern, as an architect, and architects are largely visual artists, really, had no concept of a relationship with the sea that was anything but visual. So while his houses and his the wonderful walk along the shore are visual treasures, the whole idea of any connection with the sea, of boating, fishing, connecting with it in any physical or productive way is completely ruled out. That's completely ruled out. So this is a far thing from the Pomo Indian settlements which precede him, even from the logging industry and the ranching industry which preceded the modern sea ranch, because they were connected to the sea, at least in terms of the shipping that they were engaged in. So I'm not critical of Sea Ranch, but it is a perfect example of how people have come to the shore to sit and to look, not to do. And this alienation from the sea, which this reinforces, is a, in my view, alienation from our own human selves, because humanity began at the shore 164,000 years ago, longer. It has been nurtured by the shore and the sea. We are in our origins amphibious creatures, and now this this attitude of seeing and sitting but not doing is alienating us from something that is something that should be our heritage and not just our memory.
It seems we must be of two minds up this way. You know, our coast, the headlands are dotted mostly with pretty expensive homes where people don't really spend the whole year gazing out west, but a few vacations, maybe a year. And then we have many people with a deep, love of the sea, including just watching it, but walking along it and so forth, and a great concern about what's happening to the sea. I wonder if you could just finish this part with a word about protection. Some of the people I know believe that are great believers that the sea can be protected and restored, but that it takes an effort on our part. I wonder how you feel about that.
Well, it would take an enormous effort on our part, since 7/10 of our globe, which shouldn't be called Earth, it ought to be called ocean, this point made by some wag, but I think there's a weight to this point. To tackle that would be the greatest single mega engineering project that mankind has ever even thought of, much less attempted. But it is worth contemplating it, and I think we can certainly save the sea in an incremental way by first attending to what we take out of it and stop exploiting it. Another way we can start thinking about this is to think of the sea as an autonomous region, almost like a national park where we do not go in and plant oil rigs and drag bottoms for shellfish and cast huge nets, some of them 100 miles long, to harvest the sea. We can start thinking of, we can start reversing a trend which has been evident about the last half century, to the extension of territorial limits from, 12 miles to 50 miles to 200 miles. These are simply extensions of landlubberly perspectives of which show no sensitivity whatsoever to the sea and its inhabitants, including, by the way, ourselves. I want to return to this theme again and again, and I hope it comes through in my book. This is a really selfish motive, but by saving the sea and its environments, we're saving ourselves, because we are not standing on the shore. We have been a part of the sea now for so many thousands of years, and it has shaped us. And now, in the late 20th century, we are shaping it in ways, in incalculable ways, that we've got to become aware of and put a halt to. But the first thing we've got to think about is our relationship to the sea and how much we are sea creatures, if not in our immediate present, in our past. And let's start there. Start reversing the angle of approach. Let's turn history inside out, and let's imagine it as starting with the sea rather than ending at the shore. You know, Jonathan Rabin, the great British writer who lives just up in Seattle, has this wonderful comment when he says, the sea is all around them. But he points out, but continental people like to think that the coast is the end of the journey, the stopping point. It can't be the end of the journey. I mean, if there's a human journey that has a long future ahead of it, it's got to reconnect. It's got to go back to the sea and understand ourselves as in that light.
This is KZYX. Our program is Talking About California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. I'm talking to John Gillis, Professor John Gillis, who's the author of a highly anticipated and fascinating new book, The Human Shore, Seacoasts in History. He's also the author of a number of other books on subjects ranging from German history to British history. One book of interest to listeners would be Islands of the Mind, published in 2004. And another might be his collection of articles that he edited called Becoming Historians. I think I've got that title right. Yep. And I asked you about the beginning, John. Maybe you could just say a bit about the historian's craft, your interest in history, how it developed, and what you think is important about the subject in the minutes we've got left. A bit of time.
Yeah, well, thank you, Cal. You and I, I think, first met, or at least we were in the same room, I'm sure, with Edward Thompson. That was in the great late 60s and 70s when people were discovering that history was more than just the chronicles of kings and presidents and powerful male figures. And we were literally inventing, and you were in the forefront of this, the social and working class history, which in this country was connected to the history of African Americans. And then, bango, a little later on, not too much later, came women's history, and then came all kinds of minority histories. That movement ebbed a little bit, I think, in the 1980s, in the Reagan era, but it is it changed, it turned history on its head, and that was my inspiration. But then I began to work on these subjects, the family, memory, age relations, youth, all this wonderful stuff, untilled ground, shall we say, digging it up and nurturing it. And then, as it always happens this way, and it should happen this way, because historians, if they're any damn good, are inspired by what's going on around them. The past is connected to the present and should be. The global era comes along. You know, we talk about globalization, and we experience it every day. And so I began to go offshore. I began to first move into Atlantic history, bridging American and British history. And then I wrote this book on islands, which was inspired by my own experience of islands. And then I said to myself, well, you know, there's another subject here, which is global in nature, shores and oceans. So there I go again. And it's been a wonderful journey, and I would recommend it to anybody because, you know, historians know no bounds. They should know no bounds. They should be trespassers, and that should be our role in the world, to trespass on every period, every place deserves our attention.
John, let's just finish up. We have a few minutes left with a return to our discussion of the shore, the human shore, as you call it in your new book. Where do you think you want to go, or we should go with looking at and trying to understand the shore, you know, from here on out? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think there are plenty of shores to be explored. In fact, north of you, you even have a place called the Lost Coast, and that's always intrigued me because that suggests to me something that I'm very aware of, and that is that the shore is a largely forgotten piece of not only history but geography, and in part that is because people go to the shore to forget. This may seem odd, but my study has suggested that people go to the shore to forget, turn their backs on the world, so that the shore is not seen as, for example, a Civil War battlefield, as a place to visit and remember and commemorate and so on. And in fact, just to put an example right in front of you, 100 years ago, if we'd had a big storm, and we did have big storms like Sandy visit the coast, the shore would have been littered with wreckage of ships and whales beached and so on. And that reminder of the storm would have lasted there, would have been left there to molder for sometimes years, sometimes decades. I remember when I first went to the coast of Maine in some of the coastal towns like Belfast, there were still hulks in the water of three masters that had been just left to rot along with the piers. So people didn't clear away the wreckage in those days. Today we, within weeks, the beaches will be cleaned up and all that stuff will be removed. Now, so my point here is that we probably ought to treat the shores with a little more attention to what has happened there. In other words, what would be wrong with putting some monuments on the shore to storms like Sandy to remind people? So here's my point. I'm sort of rambling at this point, but I think it's an important point to make. If we were to bring the shores back into history and into geography and make them again a subject of public concern, of political concern, we might just get to the point where we could begin to do something serious about the problems of pollution, the problems of overbuilding, the problems that we've been talking about in this program. But as long as we treat them as sort of prehistoric, purely natural, and so on, we'll never get around to that. Because as long as we treat something as natural, then we leave it alone, right? I mean, that's the very definition of the natural is beyond the reach of human attention. And that just doesn't work any longer. We are too involved in at every level with nature to pretend that it somehow stands apart from us and we have no responsibility to it. So that's one thing. That is definitely one thing I would recommend. Go down to your local shore, go down to the Mendocino Coast, Point Reyes, wherever you want to go, Lost Coast, and poke around and see how much history you can actually find there. And you'll be amazed at what you discover and how much further you want to know about that history.
Okay, and putting history and the shore together, you know, when we first met, we talked about a kind of history from below. And I don't know if this is connected to your work or not, a history from below, but one of our colleagues wrote actually a story about the wrecking and that relationship with the shore. So in a minute or two, is there a connection between the kind of bottom-up history we talked about then and your work on the shore today?
No, look, Tal, you and I go back to the same kind of roots of the so-called bottom-up history, working-class history, the history of the plebeian classes. Absolutely. My personal heroes, as well as my historical heroes, are coastal people, women as well as men, who know how to live with the shore. They are a remarkable group of people. They know how to do things that landlubbers can only hire for. They build boats. They gather. They hunt. They fish. They build their own houses. They are a true working class in the sense that they are the people I know in Maine, at least, among the fishermen, which means largely lobstermen now, are incredibly self-energizing. They are, for the most part, entrepreneurs. They operate as individual entrepreneurs. They embody the best of the kind of almost Jeffersonian America, of self-sufficient, self-standing, totally engaged people. So I have enormous admiration for those people, much less admiration for those who have planted themselves in these huge McMansions on every coast, and who do not know the sea, and apart from the visual splendor of it, scarcely appreciate it.
John, I think we're out of time. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us this morning. It's been a wonderful time for us to talk and think. I want to thank our listeners again, and say that this is talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and we'll be back again next Thursday at 9 a.m.